first question in the interview was, who do you know? And I said, well, I just graduated from school. I've been working in London for a couple of years. And he said, yeah, thanks. See you later. And I remember thinking at that time, there is never going to be a time that I don't know people. I am going to know people and I'm going to build relationships with people. And that was kind of one of the foundational things that I have built throughout my career is relationships.
Hi, Lee Brooks here from Cromulent Marketing. On this episode of the Cromunity Podcast, I'm sitting down with Jackie Murphy, Chief Marketing Officer of Ovic Networks here in Waterloo, Ontario. I first met Jackie in 2005 when she was with the venture capital firm Tech Capital Partners, and since then our paths have crossed many times. Jackie's experience is amazing, and as a conversation unfolded, what happened was we essentially used her career arc as a narrative device to explore the roots and the present state of the local tech community, about venture capital in Canada, and about the importance of following your passions. I had a ton of fun talking to Jackie, and I learned a great deal, and I hope you do as well. Thanks for sitting down with me.
My pleasure.
For having me here in your really fabulous office space. It's really, really impressive. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
We are sitting in Ovic's space, and you are, I noticed recently now, the Chief Marketing Officer. Maybe
yes.
That's just official. You updated LinkedIn, or I imagine I've sort of thought of you as in that role for 4 or 5 years anyway.
Yeah, the role hasn't really changed.
Yeah.
But thank you.
But the title has, so that does count for something. Bit of recognition.
Recognition for the team.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And you're the head of the team. so I was creeping you a little bit on LinkedIn today just to kind of familiarize myself. I had remembered, you know, you've been at Fongo and Tech Capital, something I've wanted years to sort of talk to you about, and going back to Pickstream and Cisco, that local legend. And then also noticed Laurier and Ivy, you've instructed there,
mm-hmm.
and the Art Allies entrepreneurship
mm-hmm.
side. You've done a lot.
I'm old, Lee. That's all that says. I'm old.
It's a diverse range of experience, right? And I'm curious what, and that's not even to mention the volunteer things as well. I know from my own experience, they contribute to, you know, you learn, and as we were talking about just before, you learn from every experience. Can you tell me a little bit about Ovic in particular, and maybe building on, you know, what are the lessons you brought into this as you stepped into a very early stage company and grown it to whatever state. Scale up, is that what we call?
Scale up, yes.
You call companies now?
Officially, yes.
Yeah.
For sure. So a little bit about Ovic. So we are a SaaS software company. We have about 170 employees now, most based in KW. We also have an office in Ottawa, Canada. We have an office in Barcelona in Spain, and we also have an office in Milton Keynes in the UK.
Okay.
So some new challenges, some fun challenges, trying to build collaboration between the different offices and make sure that, you know, training and documentation and marketing collateral and all those types of things are being shared worldwide. So that's an exciting challenge for us mm-hmm. this phase. We have been around since 2011. So company was founded in 2011, really started to get its legs around 2013 with our first financing round. And I joined the company in October of 2013.
Okay.
So I've been with the company for quite a long time. I was the second marketing hire. Our first marketing hire was a co-op student, Lindsay, who did a fabulous job and actually trained me when I first joined the company. So that was awesome. And it's been a wild ride.
You know, she's going to tell that story forever,
for sure.
Right? Every time you show up in LinkedIn feed, you know what I trained her.
Absolutely. She also ate an entire box of Goldfish crackers as part of her co-op challenge, which was a day to remember. She's a bit of a legend here at Ovic. A lot of evolution of the company, obviously, since that time, and yeah, we're killing it, which is exciting. Team's really happy. Our partners, we call our customers partners.
Always
sell,
confuses me. Well,
yeah,
in your case, though,
we sell through the channel.
Yes.
Right. So we very much partner with our partners in order to sell our product. And so, yeah, we refer to them as partners. A little bit confusing for sure for people who aren't selling through the channel, but you have to speak in their language, right? Otherwise, it just doesn't resonate.
Outside in.
Exactly. So yeah, so we've been building out also distribution channels, international markets. We're just about to open an office in Australia, which is super exciting. Mm. So that's a big 2019 project for us.
Couldn't get it in before the Australian Open?
Nope. And yeah, so... So yeah, just going global now. So bigger, as we were talking about earlier. And then we have a bunch of different growth vectors that we're focusing on. So one is geography, one is go-to-market strategy, one is product development, obviously, new product initiatives. So yeah, having lots of fun.
So more stuff to sell
more efficiently in more places.
That's right.
Nice.
Yeah.
Get all three of those. And...
Exactly.
prior to AVIC, so we had Art Allies and Fongo. Do you want to talk at all?
Sure. Yeah, I can talk to you a little bit about my own career evolution, which is, as you mentioned, a little bit all over the place. But it's funny how when you look back at your career, you can see how all of the roads kind of led to where you are today. Yeah. So
it's easy to tell a story looking back.
Exactly.
You're to try to predict it.
Yeah. So I always knew that I wanted to be in tech and in tech marketing specifically. In university, I remember working through case studies and thinking, oh God, these are all consumer packaged goods type case studies. Why aren't there more tech case studies? And we were in, you know, the heart of Kitchener-Waterloo. I went to school at Laurier for business, and I was frustrated by the fact that there were no tech case studies. And when I graduated from Laurier, I was offered a role back in a classroom teaching at the Ivy Business School for a couple of years. And I remember at the time thinking, this is not really what I want to do. But everybody around me was saying that I'd be absolutely crazy to turn that opportunity down. So I did it, and it was wonderful. So I went and I taught there for a couple of years. And the thing that was great about that was it made me such a natural presenter, because I had to essentially present every single day for 2 full years.
I always have that appreciation for teachers.
Yeah.
Like my mom's a kindergarten teacher, and it seems a lot of people I've worked with, their parents have been teachers.
Yeah.
And you work with people and they get very nervous about a presentation, and not to sort of diminish that, they're important. But then you think, yeah, teachers are doing that for
they present
six, 7 hours
the time,
a day.
Right? And so you lose the butterflies, right? Yeah. And it was a fun training experience at the Ivy School. Essentially what they would do is take students who had just recently graduated from business school and throw them back in the classroom, and we would teach the first and second year business program. We would train each other. So the second year teachers would train the first year teachers. And the second year teachers were just brutally honest to the first year teachers. So it was trial by fire. You know, you're standing up in front of a classroom and you're doing this presentation, and at the end of the lecture, you would just get torn apart by the second year instructors. So then the next time you would go and you would be better, right? It's like Toastmasters on steroids, right? Yeah. So that was a really good start. But after that, I knew that I wanted to get into tech marketing, came back to KW, knocked on every single technology company door. And at that time, it was very much a engineering first, well, still very engineering focused. It's still very engineering focused. But at that time, there were really no sales and marketing teams working in any of the engineering based companies. Yep. It was kind of a...
Yeah, and you're not saying they were remote teams. It was
there
these
were no
companies
teams.
Did not have.
Yeah, the philosophy was very much build a mousetrap and they will come. We don't need sales and marketing. And in some instances, that was absolutely true. Or the KW office was very much a development arm of a larger entity that would do the sales and marketing from California and whatnot. So at the time, there was an advertising agency in Waterloo called Taz Communications, and they did all of the advertising and marketing for a lot of the tech companies in town. So I essentially stalked them until they hired me and worked there for about a year and a half, and then
Stalked is such a loaded term. Pursued.
I pursued aggressively.
You nurtured.
Yeah. Used all of my marketing techniques to convince them that I was absolutely worthy of a job there. So my first interview with Taz, I actually had to reach out to them 3 times and prospect them 3 times in order to get a job there. The first time through, I actually met with a gentleman, and the first question in the interview was, who do you know? Because it was for an account executive job, and it was, you know, how are you going to sell Taz's services? Who do you know? And I said, well, I just graduated from school. I've been working in London for a couple of years, so I don't really know anybody in the KW region, but I'm really, you know, full of energy and passion, and I'm sure I'm going to do a great job. And he said, yeah, thanks. See you later. And I remember thinking at that time, there is never going to be a time that I don't know people. I am going to know people, and I'm going to build relationships with people. And that was kind of one of the foundational things that I have built throughout my career, is relationships with people. So not just, you know, I'm connected to them on LinkedIn, but...
Well, even that is... You know, you mentioned the better mousetrap fallacy earlier. It's, you can have all this ability, energy, ideas, but if people don't know that.
Right.
Then it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Right. And it's such a small community here, but with so many tentacles, right? So you're really only 1 degree of separation away from most people.
Yeah.
And so I learned a lesson there, in that who you know is just as important as what you know, and made a real effort to integrate myself into the community, did work with Communitech, did work with the KW Community Foundation over the years, and have really built my relationships with a lot of people in a lot of different sectors in this community, and that's paid off in spades, right? I've done a lot for the community, but the community has done a ton for me, so.
Well, neither works without the other.
Right.
Right? You have to know people in order to, you know, have those conversations and have the opportunity to show what you know.
Yeah.
And I always look at the similar sort of two-sided coin of marketing communications efforts and tactics with what's the message and what's the content you're spreading. Like great messaging, great content, doesn't matter if you don't get eyeballs. Eyeballs don't matter unless you're directing them to something that pursues your marketing strategy, your communication objective to try to change some behavior in your audience.
100%. Yeah. 100%. So yeah, so worked at Taz for a bit and then moved across the street to a company called Pickstream.
Well, and in working for Taz, you would have worked with a number of clients, right?
Yeah. And a lot of the tech and marketing relationships that I now have stem from those days. And it's funny, when you're little, right? I was very little at that time, and you're meeting other little people, right? So nobody is really senior at that point. I'm interacting with people who are junior, just like I am. But then 20 years later, we're all the ones running the companies, right? So it's really important to start building your network, even at a young age, because it's amazing. You blink and all of a sudden you're the oldest one in the room and you're not sure how that happened, but your connections are amazing, right?
It's interesting. I'm wryly grinning here because you just reminded me of, I don't know if you'll remember this. So when I started at Sandvine as a co-op, I was working with Amanda Weber, and I was involved on campus with a number of sort of campus groups. And one of the things I was trying to do was bring the real world on campus and show people, if you're trying to get a job, you want to go into work in the real world, here's sort of a door into that. And another aspect of it was, just because you're a technical person in engineering or computer science or math or whatever, doesn't mean you have to, quote unquote, limit yourself to those roles. You can, you know, work in a different field. And so I asked, invited you and Amanda to come to campus and speak about modern marketing, right? The most any of us had been exposed was like 4 P's. And so I remember this, it's a bittersweet memory, because I remember you
oh God, both, what did I do?
You came, you're so wonderful. Looking back, I'm like, oh, I just totally like, hey, you want to come talk on campus? It was great that you did. Despite all the promotion we did, we had like 8 or 10 people come out. And I was disappointed. I was sort of furious and I was confused why no one else was, why people weren't seeing this great opportunity. Anyway, you and Amanda came, did a great job. And one of the things that you asked in the room, and I think it was you who asked, was who here has a LinkedIn profile?
Oh,
and this was 2005, it would have been. And like three or four, like I think my hand went up and two or three others. And you just sort of brought that memory up by saying, you can connect with people, and then it's neat how everyone sort of progresses. My own class, I have computer engineering. Most of my class, or a large chunk of my class, went out west, right? They're in Seattle or in their valley. Most of them are in tech, and a lot of them got in at Amazon and LinkedIn, these companies very early. They have been well rewarded, but it's neat to see the cohort.
Absolutely.
The cohort effect of everyone kind of moving, riding the waves of growth.
Yeah. Absolutely.
A little trip down memory lane. And Ed, thank you for coming on campus.
Yeah, anytime.
To speak all those years ago.
That's so funny. I have no memory of that.
Yeah, I was trying to remember the exact. It's like modern marketing or marketing in the real world or something. And yeah, I'm just like, why aren't people trying to better themselves? Why didn't they come out to this event?
I don't understand. Don't people want to learn?
A lot of people don't.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. But, for those who want to learn, it creates an amazing opportunity, right? Yeah. If you lean in and you invest yourself and you absorb all the information, then, it does pay off over time.
I appreciated it then. I appreciate it now. And anytime I have that chance to go and speak to a group,
that's awesome.
Pay it forward or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever term we use to say that now.
So yeah, for sure.
Thanks for sure. Again.
So the Pickstream, the Pickstream story. This is a story that I love to tell because so often we don't tell the stories about the places that we're from, and everybody knows the legendary stories about how Apple started and how HP started and how Microsoft started, but they often don't know the stories of companies in their own backyard and the impact that they've had on the community. And the neat thing about Pickstream is that, we raised a lot of money. We were closely tied to Newbridge Networks through an investment via Celtic House and Terry Matthews. And they sort of took us under their wing a little bit. And we, you know, we grew this little entity into this nice, beautiful company with about 220 people.
The importance of coaching and mentorship and learning from the mistakes that have been made beforehand, right? Getting back
to what we
talked about before.
And a lot of the senior executives were ex-HP, right? The founders were ex-HP, who had come together to do this startup in KW.
Yeah.
And so it was great in that it was a team of people who had come together with big dreams, right? They had seen big, they wanted to build big here. And so the company was always, you know, big and bold and willing to take risks. So 1999 was when I joined.
Okay.
And then in 2000, end of 2000, we were acquired by Cisco, which was really exciting. And that was bittersweet too, right? Because you put your heart and soul into a company. And I remember when the announcement was made that we were being acquired by Cisco, I actually had to go into the bathroom and cry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't admit this to many people. Well, now I guess I have admitted it to the entire world.
We'll totally edit it out.
We won't.
Because I was so emotionally invested in that company.
Yeah.
Very shortly after, the tech bubble burst and Cisco decided to lop off the entire Pickstream division. John Chambers made good decisions and said, I can see the writing on the wall in terms of the economy. I'm going to make one big fell swoop cut.
Yeah.
And it was so good because they treated the employees really, really well. Everybody got nice severance packages. Everybody was able to move on. It wasn't death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah.
And, you know, really treated us with respect, I thought, from an employee perspective.
And it's not an indictment of the company or the technology
or
the people. It was like a business decision of we cannot bring this company into the fold the way we had planned.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Exactly. We have to make some tough choices. So, and we were remote and we weren't fully integrated.
Yeah.
So it was an easy decision, right?
Yeah.
So because of that, there was a splintering effect of all the employees at Pickstream.
Yeah.
And they scattered throughout KW and beyond. And a whole bunch of little tiny companies popped up.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was Sandvine, which is where you worked.
Yeah.
And one of them was Tech Capital, which is where I worked for 10 years. And then we've kind of built this, what we have built, a Pickstream family tree.
Like LSI Logic, AdExact.
Yeah, there's so many.
Or it was Video Locus before. I can't remember what it was called because it went through.
Yep, Video Locus. And
it continues, right?
Yeah.
Like I was, as part of that research project I've been doing, I've been reading a lot of company stories and several of them have mentioned Pickstream.
Exactly. Yeah. Alex Lane has a company now.
Yeah.
So
Steve Baxel's gone.
Yeah. Many.
A few.
Yeah. So we have actually mapped out the family tree. So
okay.
If you ever want to see it, we can show you the family tree.
Yeah. I would love it.
Yeah. It's really neat. And those who were part of Pickstream have this kind of connection because we went through this crazy ride of being acquired by Cisco and then this crazy fall of all being let go on the same day at the same time. And so we're kind of bonded together forever. Right?
Yeah. I mean, you can't. There's no substitute for that, right?
No. It was really emotional, right? And we all put our hearts and souls into that company.
Yeah.
And yeah, so am I still
so
damaged?
These...
Yeah, probably. Still damaged, still in therapy for that.
So all these little, not even offshoots, these sort of net new little phoenixes. What's a plural for phoenix?
Phoenix.
So they all sort of rise from the ashes at the same time.
Yes.
And start going on their own journeys, right? So
exactly.
You said Sandvine was one, and that's sort of creation story, maybe we'll say for a different, you know, one of these days I'll sit down and go through that.
Yeah, that's a fun story.
But Tech Capital.
Yeah,
like
Tech Capital.
I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, so Tech Capital was a venture capital firm, actually still is a venture capital firm. It was a boutique firm, or is a boutique firm, that was very focused on the KW area. So Andrew Abouchar worked for a venture capital firm in Toronto, recognized the opportunity for investing in KW companies, recognized that a lot of companies in this town had potential, but there was no funding here. It's funny, you look at a map and you see that Toronto is only an hour and 15 minutes away, but there's some kind of a barrier that keeps people from driving this way on the 401.
Yeah.
Investors at that time were not coming to Kitchener-Waterloo, and so he saw the opportunity and, you know, proximity to University of Waterloo.
Market inefficiency, right?
Right, proximity to RIM at the time, and thought, whoa, this is an area ripe for the picking. So he partnered with Tim Jackson, who was the CFO at Pickstream and CEO at our exit, and the two of them started Tech Capital. And at the time, I was still locked in working for Cisco. We called ourselves the disintegration team. You know, we were helping take Cisco apart, making sure that all of the customers were taken care of and transitioned to other platforms.
That alone would be great. Like, not to dive into that one, but that would be a very interesting experience.
Yeah, and it absolutely was.
Fairly early in your career. I think back to some of the things that I did early in my career. I think I was 24, 25, and I oversaw a large chunk of an acquisition integration. And I look back. At the time, I knew it was crazy, and looking back, I'm, wow.
Wow, I did that.
Right? And so, yeah, you're looking after these. I don't know if you would have ever even done that since, right?
Yeah, like tearing a company apart? Not
And making
from that,
sure to hand off customers and transitions and...
Not like that. Certainly not to that same magnitude.
Yeah.
Right? And then Tech Capital. So we had a small fund to start, or I wasn't part of it at that point. So I was still trying to figure out where I was going to go post Cisco. And was trying to make, and this is actually kind of a fun story, was trying to decide where I was going to go next. And I had three companies that I was fairly down the path with in terms of discussions. And I found out I was pregnant for the first time. And Tim Jackson, who was our CFO, CEO at the time, had said, hey, I know that you're talking to all these companies, but before you make a decision, would love to buy you a coffee and just talk about your future career opportunities. And I've worked with you and, you know, care about where you end up next. So let's have coffee. So I was getting very close with these three, found out I was pregnant and thought, oh God, you know, now what do I do? Do I have the conversation with these companies and say, oh, by the way, yes, I'd love to take the job. Oh, by the way, I'm pregnant. Mm-hmm. Or do I not tell them?
Yeah.
Right? These are the types of things that we as women have to think about, right?
Yes.
Oh, great. She's joined now. No, now she's going on maternity leave, right? Never a good time. Mm-hmm. So I went for coffee with Tim and I walked into Williams, which is a little coffee shop.
I don't think there were any Starbuckses.
No, no Starbucks at the time. Yeah. And I said, before you say anything, I have to tell you that I'm pregnant, because I wasn't sure what the conversation was about, if he was going to offer me a job or whatnot. And I wanted to make sure, full disclosure, let's be fully transparent, right?
You know, super caffeinated beverage.
Exactly. I'm having a baby. And he says, oh my God, that's amazing. That's so great. Congratulations. Let me tell you about this job offer that I have for you. And he takes me through this amazing job offer to join Tech Capital as the third leg of the stool. He and Andrew would be the finance guys, and I would essentially be the third leg of the stool, focusing on go-to-market, marketing, sales. So they'd invest in a portfolio company. I would go in and essentially be the boots on the ground from a sales and marketing perspective, get the company its initial, you know, go-to-market strategy.
Yeah.
And then come back to the fold, make another investment. I would go do the same thing with the next company.
That does sound pretty amazing.
Right? So super amazing. Yeah. Great comp package. Everything was awesome. And then he pauses and he says, oh my God, you're having a baby. That's so great. And I'm thinking to myself, who is this person? Like, how come he doesn't care that I'm having a baby and he's still making me a job offer? So the next morning I go into Cisco and there's a present on my desk. And I say, oh, this is interesting. So I open up the present and what is it? It's a present from Tim and Andrew, and it's a book on mother and child care. And I thought, seriously, if I do not work for these guys while I'm having my baby for the first time, right, I'm insane.
Yeah.
I can join one of these startup tech companies and lose my mind trying to raise a family and also have a baby, which lots of people do, but you know the stress that's involved in working in high tech. Or I can go work in venture capital, which is also stressful, but with guys who totally understand where I'm at.
Yeah,
they both have young families.
Their behavior has shown that they understand that.
They get it, right? And so
we hear far too few of these stories.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, loyalty for life, right? And because they treated me that way, right from the get-go, again, put my heart and soul into Tech Capital, worked for them for 10 years, had two babies, both maternity leaves while I was at Tech Capital, amazing support from the company, great experiences, you know, worked with, I think it was 15 portfolio companies in total in the end, and transitioned from that third leg of the stool to a partner role ultimately, and did a lot of the deal sourcing, diligence, deal structure, and sitting on boards by the time I had left. So
like
really
how
got
amazing
to,
is...
Yeah.
Is that right? Glad you took that coffee.
Yeah, totally, right? It was great from a career development perspective, right? And they really coached me and supported me through that growth.
And just fulfillment.
Yeah.
Right? Like the variety, the skills, the experience, the knowledge.
Absolutely.
Like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So at the end of that, though, I was so burnt out. It was a tough gig. I mean, for every 100 opportunities we looked at, we'd say yes to one. We'd look at probably 300 to 400 business plans per year, entrepreneurs who are essentially coming to you and saying, here's my baby, will you invest and help me build this? Mm-hmm. And 99 out of 100 times you're saying your baby's ugly.
And the, yeah, they believe in it, and they've poured their heart and soul, if not their own, you know, funding and friends and family.
Exactly. And it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I am very much a builder. I am very much the person who wants to jump in with both feet and help build.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to do that with every single opportunity. So to say no that many times over 10 years was damaging for me.
Yeah. And you're coming up with the cold, hard facts. As much as I might like you or your
yep.
idea or what you're trying to do.
Exactly. So I became very desensitized, and I didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I became...
It's a coping mechanism,
yeah,
right?
And you see the same thing over and over and over and over again. You have to do the same thing over and over and over again. It gets easier and easier and easier, but your emotion level changes,
yeah.
right? It does absolutely affect you in terms of how you make decisions, how you deal with stress. I mean, my ability to handle stress now is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I almost have to consciously be aware of the stress levels of other people because I just don't feel it.
Yeah.
Right? So that in itself poses some challenge.
So you learned a great deal, but you needed to develop a manual empathy switch.
Exactly. I do care about this. I need to care here. Yeah. I mean, I've gotten better. The other thing that I really lost was my ability to take risks. So at Pickstream, we did all these crazy things. We were constantly taking risks from a sales and marketing perspective to hit our numbers and to build brand and all that kind of thing. 10 years of risk mitigation. So as an investor, even at the early stage that we were investing, so we were investing in two people in a garage stage.
I was going to say, that's a very, I mean, venture capital is risk. It's just,
it's
educated, it's mathematically optimized.
It's risk mitigated risk.
Yeah.
Right? So you look at an opportunity and you say, what are all the risks?
Mm-hmm.
And can we mitigate those risks
yeah.
enough to be able to actually build a company out of this?
Yeah.
So your mindset changes from guerrilla marketing to, okay, how am I going to mitigate these risks for this company?
Once you've identified as many as you can and developed a plan to address all of them, it's, okay, this has...
We can do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. But often you say, ooh, there's an IP issue here.
Yeah.
You know, easy no. Or, ooh, founder issue. Ooh, easy now.
And that could
right?
be after, what, days, weeks, months of
yeah,
due
sometimes
diligence.
6 months.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you would invest 6 months in doing due diligence with a company, and they would invest 6 months in the process with you, and then you would say no.
Yeah.
And the entrepreneur's thinking to themselves, wait a second, I thought we had a deal.
Yeah.
Well, no, actually, we were in the due diligence process, right?
Yeah.
And that's tough too, right? Because then you've built a relationship with them.
Yeah.
You've been working with them. You just haven't signed the check.
Mm-hmm.
So it's challenging. And then at the time, it was also very difficult in Canada to raise venture funds. So there were some structural decisions that were made that prevented Canadian venture capital firms from being able to raise venture capital money, because the way that you raise venture capital money is based on certain allocations. So money typically comes from pension funds, large institutional investors, and they say we will be one of four, but not more than 33% of the fund.
Yeah, they're trying to mitigate their own.
Right.
Risk,
they
right?
want some partners around the table. Right. And so there was some consolidation that happened in the Canadian ecosystem at the institutional investor layer.
So you just didn't have enough.
There weren't enough LPs
partners.
In order to actually raise a fund in Canada.
Yeah.
And the media was having a heyday because the amount of time between 2000, like, or the time period between the year 2000 and 2010 in Canada in terms of building a tech company was deadly.
Mm-hmm.
There was no venture capital, bad economy. It was just, you know, for anybody who survived that period of time in building a tech company in Canada, I mean, Sandvine was well-funded, which was a huge advantage,
yeah.
right? You had a whole bunch of money out of the gate.
Your classic startup of getting a few tens of millions.
$19.5 million seed round funding.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we had some portfolio companies that had large pocketbooks, and they were okay. But then we had the ones, it got to the point where we couldn't invest in a company unless we had two or three other investors who were investing with us at that seed round,
mm-hmm.
and we all allocated enough money to get that company to cash flow positive, because
yeah.
we knew once the investment was made, we wouldn't be able to do a follow-on round,
yeah.
even if the company was hitting it out of the park.
Yeah.
There just wasn't any money. So it was really tough.
These are really very interesting insights.
Yeah, it was painful
to
live through.
It's not something I've heard. in this level of detail or from this perspective before.
Yeah.
Like I know sort of the Sandvine story, you know, company started in 2001, right before 9/11 and general economic downturn and, you know, all the stats and everything. But to see it and to hear some more of the institutional reasons why,
mm-hmm.
I guess I've heard about the symptoms, but less about the maybe the ultimate causes.
Right, exactly. So at the end of Tech Capital, again, Tim and Andrew took really good care of me, nice severance package. We couldn't raise a fund, so we weren't able to keep the company together.
And that was 10 years or so, right?
Yeah, it was 10 years I was there, yeah. And I mean, we could have kept that going forever, but it was impossible to raise a fund at that time. Some venture capital firms actually opened offices in Montreal, because in Montreal there were other institutional investors, but you had to have a location in Montreal, and you had to have a partner based in Montreal. And we didn't have a partner based in Montreal, and we didn't want to change the DNA of the company by adding another partner. A lot of firms did add a partner, and then they were able to ultimately raise their funds. But yeah, so I left Tech Capital, and I didn't know what I was going to do next. I started Art Allies, so that was a little bit of healing for me.
Yep.
I thought, I don't want to have anything to do with venture. I don't want to have anything to do with tech. I'm done. Like, I am just done. I don't want to work with anybody in tech. I don't want to talk to anybody in tech. I'm just going to go into my little art bubble.
You need a tech detox.
I need a tech detox, and I just need to take care of myself. And so I went, I thought, okay, I'm going to do my own thing. I don't want to do something that's going to require venture to fund it. Mm-hmm. I just want to do something small. I want to do something. So one of the challenges that we had at Tech Capital was finding talent for our portfolio companies. And there's a senior executive in town that was quoted at one time saying, Waterloo region is where fun goes to die. And we work hard in Waterloo. We don't tend to leave our houses or our offices to go out and have fun, or at least at that time, we were all very much workaholics. And so that quote really resonated with me. And I think a lot of people were not coming to KW to work because, you know, if you're a senior executive and you don't end up working at the company that you were hired into, where do you go? Right? And you and I were talking about this. We have some big, huge companies. We now have some mid-market companies, and then we have a lot of startups. Mm-hmm. So the ecosystem today is way better than it was before. I think we have 1,000 tech companies in town now. There's a few big ones. We have some big corporate multinational companies that are here now.
A lot of them want exposure to the region for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And then we have a whole bunch of folks in kind of that middle range now that have grown up over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then we still have the startup ecosystem. So from a tech exec perspective, it's a much nicer climate to come into now than it was back then. And so I said to myself, what can I do to help make Waterloo region more fun? And I'm going to build arts and culture. I'm like, I'm going to build arts and culture in Waterloo region. That is going to be my mission. And then I thought, I'm one person.
I love that was the origin of it though, right? Is you saw something that
it was
you
a
wanted
need,
to do,
right?
A change you wanted to, you know, make in the world, and something that aligned with, you know, your own objectives in terms of something that was a bit more fulfilling or more aligned with sort of you as a person. And then, you know, said, how can I achieve those two things?
Right. Yeah, well, you always said to entrepreneurs, come, like, build a company based on what you know, mm-hmm. right? So if you're just graduating from university, maybe don't build a company then. Maybe go work for another company in an industry that you're interested in. See where the gaps are, and then build a company around those gaps.
That is almost sacrilegious advice. And it's advice that I agree with. I've heard, I don't know if it was Mark or Brad from Sam, but maybe both talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, you work, exactly what you just said, you work for a bit, and in understanding the industry, you see a problem that someone else, maybe it's too small for your current company to address.
Yeah.
Or they're just, it's number three on their list, and they're, you know, for good reasons, they're focusing on other things. But we balance that or counter it with this idea of entrepreneurship, you know, beat the drum. And the result is, you know, this very long tail of companies. You know, you mentioned 1,000 companies in the region, and I've heard that number for many years now. It stays at that number, and a lot of them don't grow. A lot of them, and I've interviewed people for roles on my team in the past where it's, you know, they started their own company for a few years right out of school, and they're applying, you know, for, you know, a marketing role on my team, and their experience is interesting, but hasn't prepared them at all for what I needed them to do at an established company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough. I don't know what the right balance is. I certainly lean more towards, you know, you're not a failure if you don't start a company out of school.
Right.
Right? Like, and it's okay. It's okay to join, especially if you've gone through co-op and all these other things. It's okay to join a company, work there for a few years.
Yeah, you're not selling out.
Find your feet. Learn how, like, I learned so much being a part of Sandvine's growth.
Yeah.
And I can apply that elsewhere. I can work with other people.
Make your mistakes with somebody else's money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is a good lesson. Because you're going to make mistakes.
Well, and you're learning different, like my Sandvine experience. I love how international that company was.
Mm-hmm.
We grew globally, but even just in the office, you could walk through, you'd hear half a dozen languages. And it's like, wow, we have this giant support organization, this services organization. We're doing our own manufacturing. We're doing our own marketing. We have legal. We have finance. We have everything in-house. And, you know, I was reasonably early. I wasn't at the startup of the stage there, but you got exposed to all of these things. And so your domain knowledge of the problems you will encounter, you know, you can apply those stepping in somewhere else.
Yeah.
Whereas if you start something right out of school, you better have a damn good network of contacts and mentors, because you don't even know what you don't know.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And then the other good lesson that I learned at Tech Capital, or just in life in general, was talk to your customers, right? So when you're starting a company, when you get to that point, whether it be right out of school or after you've worked for another company for a number of years, the first thing you need to do is go out and talk to people that you're actually going to sell your product to. Because if they're not willing to buy it, then why should you build it?
Yeah.
Right? And sometimes they don't know that they want it. And, yeah, you know, there are
definitely all these classic things, right?
You know, Twitter, right? Like, yeah, who would have ever thought that people would, yeah, want Twitter? But people wanted Twitter.
Or the, right, Henry Ford faster horse.
Exactly.
Thing, which is actually, I think, taken out of context if you read about it. You reminded me, I heard Alex Hoff speak a number of years ago, right around the beginning of AVIC. And the advice he gave the audience at one of these community tech events was, beware the golf clap.
Yeah.
You go in, you present, you're trying to build business, you're trying to present your roadmap, get people interested, and they give you this.
Yep, good job. Yeah, sure, we'd buy that.
And now you can leave and fool yourself into thinking that's, you know, the ink just needs to dry on that check.
Right.
Or, you know, hard truth.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah. So what I did was I had my two segments, right? So I'm not an engineer, so I can't build something. So I have to rely on other people for my goods and services, right? What am I going to offer? Mm-hmm. And I thought back to high school, and at that time I thought I was going to be an artist, a photographer, and I was thinking of going to the Ontario College of Art and, you know, pursuing my dreams as an artist. My dad convinced me that business school was probably a better option, so I did that instead. But I always still had that passion for visual arts, mm-hmm, and it's definitely an interest of mine. And so when I was thinking arts and culture, well, I'm going to, you know, build arts and culture, I thought, okay, what can I actually tackle as one individual? Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay,
spray paint.
Exactly, right? Let's take a look at this visual arts market in KW that, like, there's no visual arts here, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to build visual arts in KW. So I started poking around and, oh, stumbled across a couple of artists. Oh, we do have artists here in KW. Met them. They introduced me to other people, reached out to some connectors in the arts and culture community. They connected me to other artists.
Because that's a whole other community.
Oh,
and
my
it's
God.
One that you don't normally
It is
bump
such
into,
an
right?
incredibly beautiful, rich, diverse community,
yeah,
that in itself is not connected.
There are all these hidden communities,
right?
Yeah, it takes a spoke or something to
exactly. But
them.
But they were all working in their own studios,
yeah,
and they weren't necessarily connected to each other, and so it was a real process to find them. Mm-hmm. Then
they're not on email.
They're not. They don't necessarily have websites,
yeah,
right? So it's lifting up a lot of little rocks and talking to people and reaching out. Calling, emailing, explaining to them what I'm trying to do, trying to build that trust, right? I'm really just trying to figure out if I can help. Would you be willing to meet with me? Interviewing them, talking to them about their pain points and whether or not there would be an opportunity for me to build a business around that. Mm-hmm. And then I reached out to a lot of my tech friends and said, hey, how do you buy art? And they said, oh, typically when we're on vacation. Yeah, no, not so much. So in Toronto, and in San Francisco, people have tiny little apartments or condos,
yeah,
and they buy beautiful artwork. And they buy from art galleries and artists because they walk by them every day on their way to work.
Okay.
And it's just part of the DNA, right? And so I would go to friends' houses in Toronto and they'd have beautiful artwork. I'd go to friends' houses in Kitchener-Waterloo and they'd have an IKEA print, right? Or something from Winners or,
yeah, Home Sense or
Pier One,
yeah,
right? Or they would have bought artwork on a cruise ship when they were on vacation.
It's a functional, you have a blank wall.
Exactly, right? I have
Fill
some
it.
Furniture and I need something to match,
yeah,
because I have a blank wall,
yeah,
right? And
this is interesting. The thing that I buy when I am when I travel is art.
Right, because you have time.
And I don't have a fancy camera. I have not worked on any photography skills at all.
Yeah.
Other people can produce better things than I can. And I would certainly like to reward the ones that have. So if there's like a market day or something, I'll go walk through and buy a print or buy, you know, in some cases an original. And so that's what adorns the walls of our house.
Yeah, which is great, right? So you have invested in original art. Yay, Lee.
And it's a memory.
It's a memory.
You see it and you're like, some of the pieces are just,
And it was too hard. It was too hard for the tech community that is working its butt off, right? Never leaving the office, never leaving home, to go to gallery openings or studio open houses or even, we have these, summer fairs where you can go around and you can tour a bunch of different studios and things like that. They just, first of all, finding out about the information, finding out about the artists is tough.
The worlds are separate.
They're separate worlds.
And this is pre-Etsy.
And the tech community is busy, right? And so they don't slow down. They don't take the time to look up.
And in some cases, overly pragmatic or practical or utilitarian.
Yeah.
Like, I needed to fill a spot on my wall.
Exactly.
I got a thing that did.
Exactly, right?
It's like you're missing the beauty in...
Yeah, well, when I find a painting that touches my soul, like I literally find artwork that touches my soul to the point where when I think about it, it makes me cry, which is a little over the top, I know, but I try to inject that into the tech community a little bit through Art Allies, right? Yeah. Building the bridges between the two communities and teaching people that art doesn't have to be pretentious or scary, right?
Yeah,
it doesn't have to be, right? How do we make it less scary? We put the price on it.
Mm-hmm.
We introduce you to the artist in a way that is not threatening.
Do I have to haggle?
Right? Don't ever haggle. Yeah. You don't haggle with artists. Why? Because they already way underpriced their work, right? And they're already starving for the most part.
I put 97 hours into this, but $30.
You can have it for $30, right? It gets crazy. They're not business people, right? Yeah. So if somebody from the tech community who's used to work, negotiating contracts, goes to an artist studio and is priced at $500 and they say, I'll give you $250. What do you think the artist is going to say? Okay. And it's not fair. $500. Pay the $500.
Yeah.
Right? It's nothing to you. Right? You might think it's a lot, but guess what? That piece of work is going to mean so much to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes time to find the piece that you're looking for. Yeah. But
it's the difference. You're getting a piece that means something.
That's right.
Versus just some mass-produced.
That's right. Yeah. It's original.
Yeah.
Right? And people come into your house and they say, wow, where did you get that?
Yeah.
Right? And I say, oh, wow, I got that from Amy Ferrari.
And you have a story.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right. And I know the artist. And let me tell you the story behind the painting, because the story behind the painting is even better than the painting itself.
Yeah.
And that's what gives the context and the flavor to it, right? So I did Art Allies for a while.
Yeah, and just listening and just sort of looking. I mean, obviously the listeners can't see this. You're very animated. And
I'm never animated.
this beaming smile on your face. This is clearly something is very important to you.
Yeah. And so Art Allies healed my soul.
Yeah.
And spending time with those artists absolutely healed my soul from Tech Capital. Tech Capital was lovely, but doing venture for 10 years was really tough for me. And then Dave Bullock came knocking on my door and said, hey, let's grab a coffee. I'd love to hear how things are going with Art Allies. And I said, great. So we went to Starbucks and we had our coffee.
These coffees.
Yeah, these coffees, right?
They're always undertones.
They're a little suspicious, right? So I sat on the board of Dave's company at Tech Capital, and a company called Live Hive.
Oh, yeah.
And so we met.
Played foosball against them.
Yes, you may well have. Yes, the foosball tournament. Yes, the annual Tech Capital foosball tournament.
Multiple winner.
That's right. You were a champ. So yes, we had coffee and he said, how's Art Allies? I said, oh, it's really good. I feel like this is really getting some legs. I feel like I'm changing things in KW. There's a lot more art. I'm seeing art in offices. Communitech has this great art program now.
And you've continued that here.
We have some artwork here. Yeah. So I feel like the startup community has really started to embrace the arts community, which is amazing, right? Mm-hmm. Like that is exactly what I was hoping to plant a seed, right? I'm not going to take credit for everything that's happened, because a lot has happened without me being involved at all. But when we started, nobody had artwork in their offices, and now they all do. So that makes me so happy. So met with Dave, said how things are going. I said, they're going great. He said, great. Do you want to come be my VP marketing at this company called Fongo? And I remember at the time thinking I was going to throw up because I loved Art Allies. But whoa, to be the VP of marketing at a tech startup, that had always been my dream, right? And I hadn't been in an operational role in 10 years.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is such a great opportunity. Am I ever going to get this opportunity again?
And you'd get to focus on one, whereas with Tech Capital, you were you were dropping in and doing their marketing
exactly
very, very quickly.
And then moving along, yeah. So the opportunity was really exciting for me. The management team that he had assembled was a team that I knew and really loved. So Bobby Holt, John Astorino, you know, JP Bavnani. I'd worked with all these guys before, and I knew that they were a great management team. And so I was like, give me some time. I need a couple of days to think about this. Yeah. And then ultimately decided to join Dave Bullock and jump back into tech, which is something I swore I never would do. I was done with tech, remember?
Yeah.
Done.
This is why we shouldn't swear.
It's a drug.
Or say never.
It's just a drug, right? And then from Fongo, moved to Avik. Mm-hmm. So Mark Morin, obviously worked with him at Pickstream. Yeah. He's a bit of a legend himself in terms of, you know, serial entrepreneur. Started Pickstream, sold it to Cisco, started Sandvine, co-founder, started Sandvine, I was IPO, and then now Avik, and, you know, it's gangbusters at Avik. So a lot of wisdom, a lot of knowledge, someone that I really wanted to work with again. Knew Alex Hoff from Sandvine, knew that he was great, had worked with David Yaw on the board of the KW Community Foundation. So again, an amazing management team.
Well, getting back to, you know, one of the earlier themes is that network and...
Exactly.
And not in... Not networking like a skeezy way, networking like a genuine...
Genuine
people.
Relationships.
Relationships, like working with each other, complement each other's skill sets.
Exactly. It's a bit of a mafia.
Yeah.
Right? The Pickstream mafia.
Well, and as we were saying before we sort of actually started recording, the, you know, go back 15 years versus now, there are more scale-ups in this region, in, you know, the larger Waterloo region, Kitchener, Waterloo, Cambridge, and... Avik is one of that handful, but also something I get the impression when I look at Avik is a senior leadership team, right? Knowing the value of hiring in people with experience, and then also a very good, you know, your team's what, 50 people now or something?
40, I think 40 now.
Like your team has grown from, you know, you being number two, you now had, you know, 40 people, and obviously they're not all senior, but you built an organization that can bring in, you know, more junior people, more intermediate people, and help to teach them. And that's the next generation of
Absolutely.
Folks.
Absolutely.
Someday we'll be sitting down in whatever replaces podcasts and talking about the Avik story and how that set them all off on these different, you know, these different paths.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. It's taken me a long time to find a company that's as exciting as Avik.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like you said, as we've gone through an awful lot of experience, And your experience is amazing. Thanks for relaying it here. To then find somewhere that will scratch the itch and, you know, will present a challenge, an exciting challenge.
Yes.
Also let you leverage the skills you've built, the experience you have, the leadership aspect growing, you know, being part of growth. There aren't that many opportunities for that.
Right.
You know, I certainly hope over time, you know, more companies locally continue to grow and present those opportunities for the more experienced people. Because it could be, I imagine, a major culture shock to go and step into, you know, a company of 15 people who are still, you know, like we said at the beginning, very engineering focused and don't know what they don't know yet.
Yeah, yeah. And I would absolutely advise people to hire people. So we've heard this before, right? So in building out the marketing team here at Avik, I aimed high in terms of seniority, right? So I brought people in at the manager and director level from the get-go. And I did that knowing that we'd be building this company and we would have limited resources to start. So I really needed people who knew what they were doing, right? Especially in areas where I didn't necessarily have the expertise.
Well, and you don't have a year to...
We don't have a year to learn.
You're passionate, you're exciting, you're smart. but we need it now
right? So I really needed to hire people who had the skill set that I didn't have and who could grow with the team, right? So right from the get-go, hired, you know, three great people who have essentially been the pillars of our marketing team here, and they've been absolutely instrumental in helping us build that organization of 40 people now, right? So
if I may, you're here, you're excited about it, but you don't look like you're being, to use your word, damaged. by This seems like a good balance.
Yeah, it's a good balance. Yeah. And I always knew that I was more of an operator than a governor, right? The natural place for me to be is absolutely inside a company, building a company.
Yeah.
I'm much happier getting my hands dirty and working with people and coaching people. And that's what I really love.
One thing that has come up a few times in our conversation is that emotional investment. And I think it's a double-edged sword, right? You're going to be facing, you know, if you're in a startup or trying to grow or scale a company, there are going to be some tough times, and you will need an implicit motivation and investment to push through them. But at the same time, you know, I've seen friends and colleagues do this. They become too emotionally attached to their company. And, you know, we all talk about family and all this stuff, and they start to really think that it is. And every so often, cold, harsh reality of, you know, the business world can topple that. And I remember one thing that Tom Donnelly from Sandvine said is you have to give a shit, but not too much of a shit.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Finding that balance to preserve your own health, your own mental health and well-being, and or physical health, right? Stress can
100%.
Be incredibly damaging.
Yep.
And the balance is different for every person. But if people could take something away from this, it's recognize that.
Yes.
Right?
100%. I've had three incidents in my life where I've gone to the edge, right, of my body breaking down, right? My brain doesn't tell me that I'm feeling stressed. My body tells me that I'm feeling stressed. Yeah. And so now I watch for those signs and symptoms.
Yeah.
And every once in a while they crop up, you know, I get an eye infection or a little bit of a funny rash, probably again, sharing too much information, but you know,
for me, it would be more migraines than normal.
Exactly.
Right.
I've
been blind 3 of the last 7 days.
Yeah. And as you, as you get older, you start to recognize like, this is not normal behavior for my body. What's happening?
And you trust it more.
Yeah. So yeah, mental health for sure is something that I'm way more conscious of now than I was when I was younger. Of my own mental health and also the mental health of the team around.
Any manager or leader, I think it would be rare, anyone who's had a reasonable length career to not, from the management or leadership perspective, need to, I can't even think of the right word here, but to need to manage mental health of the team.
Absolutely.
Whether acute, you know, acute incidents or just...
Just general,
yeah.
Right? And everybody deals with so many different things, right? And, you know, we have a very flexible work environment here, so people come and go. And we have an unlimited vacation policy, but we have to take a minimum of 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And then we also have a no assholes rule so that people don't violate the, you know, take advantage of the unlimited vacation policy. So we've got those bookends, but we try to really make sure that people are taking time for themselves and taking care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. In true tech fashion, we've overstayed our stay in this meeting room. thanks so much, Jack.
My pleasure.
It's been, I mean, I knew it would be fun and educational, and it's more than surpassed, you know, those expectations.
Awesome. Well, it was great chatting with you.
Well, that does it for part one. Obviously, we barely scratched the surface of Jackie's experience. There were a number of topics I would have loved to dive into a little bit more deeply, and I had a few written down ahead of time that we didn't even get to in any capacity at all. But fear not, Jackie has generously agreed to sit down with me again in a couple of weeks, and I will post that as a part two. So stay tuned, and thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Community Podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed making it. Thanks again.